Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and this is Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognize, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I speak to Irish-Palestinian artist Roisin El Sharif.
People ask you, so Do you agree that Israel has a right to exist? Do you believe Israel has a right to exist? And almost what you say in that moment will determine whether you're a good person or a bad person. Because, and this is, I just want to hit home that if you ask this question to any Palestinian, you're essentially asking this Palestinian to agree with the forced displacement of their own family. You know, so no, I don't agree that Israel has a right to exist at the expense of another people.
Roisin lives in Galway with her parents. Her mom is from Leitrim and her father is from Gaza. And in this conversation, she talks about growing up as an Irish Palestinian, and she shares her perspective on the past 6 months in particular. And I started our conversation by asking her about a book that she had brought in with her.
This is by a woman, an English woman who's lives in Lebanon. Her name is Rosemary Saya. She married a Lebanese man back in the day and has written loads of books. And I think one of her first books was about Palestinians, and it was Peasants to Revolutionaries. And then this is her latest book, Becoming Pro-Palestinian, which is literally just testimonies from loads of different people who have a connection to like Lebanon and Palestine. Basically, in one of the chapters, there's a chapter by an Irish doctor, Philomena McKenna, who went to Lebanon in the 80s and hadn't a clue about anything really. Yeah. And she went with the Norwegian Red Crescent, which I believe Mads Gilbert is a part of.
Okay,
so it was the same.
It was
the same. The Norwegians kind of really, along with other people like the Swedes, really headhunted, you know, trying to help the refugee camps and the wars that were happening in Lebanon.
Mm.
And anyway, this Irish doctor went with the Norwegian Red Crescent and ended up marrying a Palestinian. And that's my mom.
Ah, stop. Right. Okay.
It's like, oh, where is this story going? But that's basically, that's the story of how I came to be. My mom is Irish and she's retired now, but was a doctor. And she was living in Norway during, I think, not her internship, but was living in Norway and working in Norway. And then someone came to her one day and was like, listen, there's a bunch of us going to Lebanon. It's a war-torn place. Do you want to come? And because they're crying out for doctors. And that was, she was just like, yeah, you know. And I suppose the chapter is kind of, it's nice. If anybody wants to read it, it's in Becoming Pro-Palestinian. And it just literally, it's nice and familiar because it just talks about, you know, where she came from, which yeah. was like, you know, a small town in Leitrim in Manor Hamilton. And like, you know, they'd see, you know, having a television was a big deal back in the day. And yeah. like the, so that's her story, which is kind of, I think it's pretty cool.
It is really cool, yeah.
I was listening to that going, God, that's gorgeous. I didn't expect you to say, and that was my mom. So tell us about then the meeting of her and your dad.
Yeah, my mom was working in, I think she was working in a few different hospitals in Beirut, and met my dad, who was in Lebanon at the time. And you know, I think they were in Lebanon for a few years, and they were actually in Lebanon for, like, mom definitely was there for a very crucial time of the massacres of Sabra and Shatila. They're huge massacres in the psyche and the history of Palestinians and Lebanese, because, you know, a lot of the fight for Palestine against Israelis has actually been fought in neighboring countries. So Lebanon, like Palestine and Lebanon, have actually equally suffered at the hands of Israeli invasion. Now, there were a lot of political parties and different factions in Lebanon that, you know, were against each other, and a lot of Israeli meddling on like who to bring to power and all that kind of stuff. But the people ultimately suffered the most, and, you know, the people who had absolutely nothing, who were caught in the middle, and, you know, the refugee camps took a big hit because, you know, what we're seeing now with Israel kind of bombing the bejesus out of Gaza, that's actually their style. They've been bombing, you know, civilians, and like, you know, you're talking about hospitals, you're talking about refugee camps where, you know, they're just, they're refugees, like, they've got really nothing. But these are the targets that Israel goes after, do you know, and bombing the bomb shelters, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So at Sabra and Shatila is definitely, they were two refugee camps right next to each other. And they're a huge part of the dark history that Israel is involved with. And there was a hospital in the middle of those two refugee camps called Gaza Hospital. And that's where mom worked. So she was there during those, you know, massacres. And so definitely in my house, I suppose I'm very lucky that I've got like my teachers of, or the stories that I've listened to are all eyewitnesses yeah. of that part of the world. So I feel very like, I feel very close to Lebanon. I feel very close to Palestine. And I feel very close to, you know, those people of the refugee camps because my parents were there.
Yeah.
And like that was my mother's introduction into Palestinian liberation or Palestinian people, was directly through the refugees of the camps who, you know, had probably only come to Lebanon 20 or 30 or 40 years prior when they lost Palestine, do you know? So,
yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. So how long was she there before she actually met your dad?
I think they met on the first day.
Really?
I think
wow.
something. I think she was in the hospital and he had brought a friend over. That's the story that
you've been told.
That I've been told.
So was it an instant kind of a connection for them?
Well, mother would say no.
Okay.
She would be like, oh no, I didn't like him. But if you ask my dad, yeah. he was like, it's love at first sight.
Okay, oh. I love it.
So there you go.
And your dad is from Gaza.
Yes. Yes, dad would have been born in a refugee camp in Gaza, in Nusrat refugee camp, which okay. we're seeing on the television. Where dad's family is actually from was from a village called Berbera, which is like a smaller, tiny village that was next to, I think, another big town called Al-Majd or Al-Majdal. And that's present day Ashkelon.
Right.
So that's gone now. Yeah. And that is now an Israeli town. Ashkelon basically is where, round about that area where Barbara and a lot of these kind of like, you know, peasantry farming small villages were, you know. Like the vast majority of Palestinians were from the peasantry, were farming folk. So they were all about the land. Do you know? They were constantly always outside. The houses were quite small, but the verandas were huge because that's where you'd host people or that's where you'd eat. And I read a bit about Barbara. There's an amazing website called Palestine Remembered, which seems to be made by Palestinians who have gone to great lengths to map out the memory of stuff that's no longer there. So, you know, you can go up, like I looked up Barbara on this website, and it shows you that it had like a well, it had like a bakery. They've gotten the photos and they've collected memories to show you what was once there, what we have lost, kind of thing. My grandmother came and my grandfather came from Berbera. They would have lived there and it would have been taken during their time. So my aunts and uncles and my dad never knew Berbera. It was all passed, you know, down through memory.
Why the documentation of it is...
It's surreal.
Yeah, surreal and vital, I suppose. Yeah. It's not lost.
Yeah, that it's not lost. I mean, like from what I gathered, the ruins of Barbara still stand, and very close to it now is a kibbutz or an empty kind of airfield. So like no one's living on it. It's just turned into ruins. But it's so weird that this place has turned into ruins and not even 15 kilometers, the people who are from there are living in camps that become cities that, you know, become suburbs, claustrophobic. And that was never their lifestyle. They were farmers, you know, they were all about the land. And that's a very Palestinian trait for a lot of people, is that they were actually super married to the land.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Their whole lifestyle came from the food that they cultivated on this particular land and in this region. So, you know, with the loss of land, I suppose, and putting all these like farming folk in suburbs and refugee camps that ultimately became cities, they've lost their heritage, their past, their future, what they would have gone on to become, you know. I mean, they've managed to adapt very well for people who have lost a lot of, you know. And I think that's you know, you could say maybe they're unique, or you can say that just that's what humans do. Humans, like, you know, Palestinians are not unique in the fact that they're a people that have, they're the only people that have lost stuff. Many different ethnicities along, you know, have lost loads, you know. And I suppose that's the testament to the refugee, is that you have to adapt. And if you want a future for, you know, yourself and your children, you just have to kind of make a new home. But I suppose it's like a chronic homesickness, or it's a chronic sadness that never leaves you. And like it's funny because Palestinians, like if you talk to any of them, like they'll never refer to themselves as refugees. You know, they're very adamant that they have a home. It's there.
Yeah,
they will go back if not in this life, in the next, or their children. Like they're I have to say it's a very strong ethos or mentality that, you know, it hasn't, like, so I suppose that there's great comfort in that like Palestine has not been lost, because, you know, you may have taken the people, some of the people off the land, but they live and breathe it every day, from their food to their language, to their songs, to their mentality, you know.
Mm. Well, I mean, I've learned a lot, and I'm like, I feel like it's a crash course over the last few months in a world that I knew very little about, and I'm still at the tipping point, I feel. Which is why it's a privilege to sit and speak to you here today, you know, because it's constant learning. And, you know, as we're always saying, it's also the unlearning.
Yeah, I've had to do so much unlearning.
Have you?
Yeah, like there's, and I'll explain, I suppose, not so I've had to do so much unlearning. I've had to reacquire my voice. You know, I've always been quite vocal about Palestine and Palestinian rights because I'm very proud of my family and, you know, my people. And frankly, you know, they're wronged people. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
They have absolutely been wronged by so many avenues. So it's not just like I'm doing it because it's a duty. I feel like absolutely they should be talked about. But I have had to, you know, there were certain spaces that you could not be Palestinian in. So the last 5 months have been, as much as they have been excruciating to be a part of, to be a witness of, we are saying things now that you could not say even 5 years ago or 10 years ago for fear that you would offend someone. Because unfortunately, the way the narrative has been is that, like, you know, being Palestinian is offensive to certain people or in certain spaces. And I suppose I'm talking about my experience in the film industry. I'm from the film world in the fact that, like, I've worked on film sets, on shooting sets, had a great time, met a lot of lovely people, also had a terrible time sometimes. But I worked in that very kind of selective niche, you're only invited in industry. And definitely on some certain jobs, I didn't on purpose, you know, when someone asked me, where are you from? I didn't say I was Palestinian because I just knew that the air and the atmosphere in the room is going to change.
And, right.
And yeah. I can tell you that it's not with, you know, a colleague. So like I was a VFX data wrangler. I'm not going to offend my colleague by being Palestinian. I was also assistant director. I'm not going to offend, you know, one of the AD teams. The person that I might offend by being Palestinian is like the producer of HBO or the showrunner of the show I'm on, or, you know, all five American or Canadian producers. That's who I felt I couldn't be myself in front of. Yeah. You know, there's a huge power dynamic there that's totally different. And I absolutely resent that because it didn't come from Palestinians that to be Palestinian automatically equated that you were anti-Semitic or against our Jewish brothers and sisters. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, of course it is.
Like, that's not... Palestinians had no control over who came and occupied them, who colonized them, who sold them, you know? But it has always been a part of the conversation.
Is it exhausting to have the conversation because, you know, I'm not Palestinian, and yet I think a lot of people who have woken up in a way that they feel like it feels like there's no turning back from this wake up.
Yes,
that's gone on.
Brilliant.
There's kind of like, you know, I know what it's like to be told you have cancer, and I know it's a strange thing to say, but I suppose what I'm trying to explain is there's life before that moment, and then there's the life after. I changed in that moment. Forever.
Yeah.
And I feel like for me and a lot of people I know, the same thing has happened. It's like once we did actually properly open our eyes, take the full blinkers off, it's like, whoa, there is no going back now to the way it was. I suppose I'm just wondering, is it absolutely exhausting to almost have to point out the obvious, that this is not a religious issue. This is a question of humanity.
No, you're dead right. It is absolutely exhausting. And it's also like, it's a mind melt. You know, it makes you question yourself and it takes away your confidence. Definitely as a Palestinian, like always feeling that you have to justify yourself before you even open your mouth, you know. And like when you are Palestinian, you know, that narrative that has been placed on you doesn't make sense to you. Because when I think about being Palestinian, I think about my grandmother. I think about the food. I think about the dresses. I think about all my cousins with, you know, five or seven children all hanging off me. You know, I think about, you know, that's what I think about, and the smells and, you know, the jokes and the sense of humour that, like, honestly would drive you mad as well. Do you know, but it is exhausting. And I have noticed, definitely, I'm a part of a few different WhatsApp groups, and, you know, the ladies, but the vast majority of them are ladies, but there could be men. But I do, you know, it really hurts them that I've kind of just been reading the conversations, and it really hurts them when, you know, they're compassionate and they've, you know, come across this injustice and they want to talk about it, and they're met with indifference or silence from their family, or, yeah, you know, kind of like, oh, what are you worried about that for? Like, don't be worried about that. And like, it really hurts them. And I'm just like, you know, I've read a couple of these conversations and been like, yeah, it's a universal. That's like, I'm pretty sure that happened to me, that same thing where I was like, oh, people don't like Palestinians, even though, like, I don't, like, you know, now you don't like me and I haven't even opened my mouth yet. Or, you know, there's already this
prejudice.
And it's, and the worst, you know, I suppose all prejudice is terrible, but the fact of this prejudice, it's all based on lies.
Yeah.
It's based on lies that are regurgitated by the same people who occupied us or who made us beggars. These are the people talking about what we are, and like, it's bang out of order. It's super tragic that it's taken a genocide to you know, I believe people are good everywhere, and people can only do what the tools that they are given with. And the fact of the matter is, you know, Gazans who were filming their destruction, and they are the reason, yeah, that a load of Irish people and a load of people around the world are like, correct, oh my God, they don't look like terrorists. They actually look like really nice people. Or do you know what I mean? Like,
that's,
we saw
us, yeah,
so much humanity in some of the worst things I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
I also saw it coupled with incredible tenderness and humanity from, like, the men literally, like, holding their children. And, you know, these are not the monsters that the West and Zionist propaganda have led us to believe. In fact, it's the other way around.
Sure.
It's the Israeli IOF army that are the monsters.
Yes.
You know, the fact of the matter is, we have been lied to. Since the creation of Israel has happened, there has been a propaganda push to make sure that people don't know what's going on. It's too complicated. You'll never know. Oh, but, you know, Jews are like indigenous to the Holy Land. No, they're not. Like, no, they're not. Like, maybe Jewish people once upon a time, you know, the fact of the matter is, there are Jewish people all over the world. I don't understand how they can also belong to one place.
Yeah.
You know, maybe once upon a time they all originated, or a vast majority of them originated from the Holy Land. Absolutely. But, you know, 2000 years have passed since then. Like, we've had empires fall. You know what I mean? And the, yeah, fact of the matter is, whatever the Palestinians are today, they are the indigenous people. So we do have Jewish blood in us. We've got Christian blood in us. We've got, you know, like, the people were never replaced. There were always influxes of movement. There was conversions. You know what I mean? Like, the Christian population of Palestine are one of the oldest Christian, if not the oldest Christian communities. Because believe it or not, that's where Christianity came from.
Yeah.
Like, our Jesus is from Beit Lahem. So it's just like,
yeah, no,
you know, it's the same with like all the nativity plays, which I love to see because they're so cute. But like, all the little kiddies, you know, and the teachers and the parents dressing them up as Arabs, basically. But we haven't made that distinction.
No.
That we're putting keffiyehs and, like, you know, long thobes, and, you know, Palestinians today still wear those. You know, it's like Palestinians have been cut out from their history, their heritage, their land, and it's all, unfortunately, on purpose. So it does make sense. Never blamed anyone for not knowing, but there was always a frustration that, like, please, like, please know soon, because it's just crazy.
Mm.
It's crazy.
You have every reason to feel a rage about not just obviously over the past number of months, but I suppose because it's in your DNA, your entire life, you know, to feel a sense of that deep injustice. I mean, I know that anyone who knows me well knows that the one way to wind me up, and I've no problem if I mess up to say sorry, and I've been in many situations where I have to put my hand up and say, I fucked up there, I'm sorry. But if you wrong me, I absolutely see red. I can't handle it at all.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine that as a person, if that was living inside me, as in living, breathing, as part of my identity, that this feeling of being wronged, I think I'd really struggle with it. I mean, we know as Irish people, and you're Irish-Palestinian, so you have it from both sides, that you have the sense of we were wronged as a people. Your Irish heritage was wronged.
Totally.
Your Palestinian heritage was wronged, continued to be wronged. Mm. But to have that still existing, is it something, and I'm not trying to bring up anger in you, but I'm just trying to ask about how do you manage those feelings?
I have to say, who I am today is not even who I was 5 months ago, let alone even 7 months ago,
right,
where I think for a while I did have a bit of a chip on my shoulder because of the injustices around the world. I've always like really cared, as most people do. And, you know, when you know about an injustice, it's really hard to just kind of forget about it or carry on your day. It kind of niggles at you. It annoys you. And, you know, you end up saying like, oh, well, what about this? And, oh, well, that wasn't really, you know what I mean? Like, you can't. I definitely all through my 20s, there's a Scratch song called The Punisher, which is about someone who just like won't stop talking on a night out. And like, I was the Punisher, but I was always talking about Palestine, or I was always talking about, you know, like how we have to like help the global South, because technically the West has stolen everything from it. And
yeah,
it's like, it makes you enraged. But, you know, back then, nobody wanted to talk about those things. It wasn't even cool back then to talk about depression or being sad. And I definitely think the last couple of years, a lot of doors have opened, a lot of boxes have been opened, because the truth is, people need to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, you know, surface level, shallow stuff will only keep us content for a little while. And then we're like, okay, I'm still not miserable. I'm still not content.
Yeah.
The injustices of maybe being Palestinians and being a Palestinian in certain spaces absolutely got to me. Having said that, though, I was very lucky and very privileged that I'm also Irish.
Mm.
So I know for a fact that I got into a lot of... Now, I worked hard. I absolutely hustled because, you know, it's my dream to make films. And it's my dream to make a film about Palestine. And I'm sitting on a few different stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been paying attention and I've been taking notes. But it did hurt me to know that I couldn't, you know, sometimes people, I never was not proud to be a Palestinian, but I would get a lot of like, oh, you're Palestinian. Keep going, you know, hush, hush, solidarity.
Right.
You know, so like on your side, but we can't say it here. It's like, why can't we say it here?
No.
But so I've you know, 10 years working in the film industry, it wasn't always like that. You know, in Ireland, I didn't really feel that. A lot of it came with the bigger jobs, American jobs, English jobs.
Mm.
And then, you know, I was aware of it. And I was aware of it from, you know, school. I went to a few different schools. And it just wasn't always well received. You know, I suppose it's been a process that you know, if you tell people you're Palestinian or half Palestinian, you're going to get someone who understands, someone who won't think anything of it because they don't know, which
right,
is, you know, also great sometimes. And or you're going to get the temperature is going to drop,
yeah,
or you're going to get suddenly like, you know, you've said something bad and it's like. And, you know, you hold on to it. You just you play the game because this is the system that you're in. You can't change a system. So you just weave around it. But I think I'm here now to say we should change the system.
Absolutely. And I feel for people who are not Palestinian, who are maybe trying to be an ally. Actually, maybe that's the question. How can people who are not Palestinian but feel this connection to, fuck this, the world needs to change, or we need, this is not right. And, you know, if we want to live in a world, and I suppose as well, and I've had this conversation with people, I definitely think there's an added element for me because I have kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like, by the natural law of life, I'd like to think that I'll die before them. And wouldn't it be nice to leave a slightly less, I suppose, polarized world for them? And maybe that it might be a touch fairer, if not extremely fair. But there is that sense of wanting just to live in a better world. So I suppose, without me ranting on, how can we help? How can we come on board? I mean, we know we're like you. I'm in different groups, so we're trying to channel our feelings into action, which is vital. But how else can we help?
Do you know, like, Ireland has led the way in solidarity with just compassionate people being like, hang on a second, I don't care what people are telling me here. Whatever I'm seeing is not right. It's giving me anxiety and nightmares. So Irish people were very quick to be like, oh, no. You know, we won't take an official statement from a man in a uniform when we're seeing mutilated children. So no, thank you. And I suppose in a world where, like, it's crazy what we've seen in the last 5 to 6 months, because we've literally seen that international law stands for nothing. We've seen that the ICJ cannot stop the Israeli army from massacring people, and now horrific reports coming out of El Shifa of women being, you know. So,
yeah.
I suppose what we can do is, now that we know, make a commitment forever to, like, and this is not going to be a fast process. This is going to be a slow process. It's going to be a process that requires commitment, because essentially what we are trying to do is, we are trying to, you know, we've realized through all of this that, like, after 6 months, America still, you know, just from everything we've seen, which has been absolutely crazy and diabolical, like, all of this is man-made. It could have been stopped in the second week of October. It could have been stopped, but this was all intentional on purpose, because the fact of the matter is, Israel is not finished ethnically cleansing the Palestinians. They were only sort of half successful. So they occupied Palestine, and 750,000 Palestinians fled to either Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. Fled, you know, so we survived. So only half the country was occupied. So they're still on a mission to get the other bits that are, you know, Palestinian. But I think if we make a commitment, and now that we know the truth, and we don't go back to a world where we had to hush, hush, our solidarity, when our solidarity is true. It's literally based on human rights. We shouldn't have to feel guilty or feel like we're supporting something dirty or stigmatized, which is, you know, crazy. It's, yeah. This is psychological warfare to make us blame and distance ourselves away from the victims. And then somehow, because the abusers are in, you know, nice positions, money, might be Western, look like us. Like, these are all the lies that have been fed us. So we don't support an indigenous population who are going through colonization or post-colonization. Like, that's what this is. It was never about, you know, Zionism. Unfortunately, Zionism is this ideology that Jews would only be safe in their own land. And this ideology didn't come from Jewish people. This actually came from Christian evangelicalists before the 1800s, you know, and then was adopted by a non-religious, sort of atheist Jewish man called Theodor Herzl, who was he Hungarian? I'm not sure. Definitely Eastern European or Austrian. And, you know, this was, you know, the Jewish people of Europe, unfortunately, absolutely faced such horrific discrimination. And they were from there. Do you know what I mean? It's like, they were from Hungary, or they were from Austria, and they were absolutely othered. So like, I can understand Jewish Zionism, which is like, you know, we want to be a place of our own where we are safe and we are not discriminated. I absolutely understand that. And, you know, a place where they belong. But you just can't have that on a land that already belongs to someone else. And that's where, you know, the whole, you know, we keep on bypassing this, you know, crucial fact that there is already a people on this land that you have decided to call home. Like, it was already a home to a people. And so this is what happens, you know, 80, 90 years later. You know, people don't realize is that when, you know, people ask you, so do you agree that Israel has a right to exist? Do you believe Israel has a right to exist? And almost what you say in that moment will determine whether you're a good person or a bad person. Because, and this is I just want to hit home that if you ask this question to any Palestinian, you're essentially asking this Palestinian to agree with the forced displacement of their own family. You know, so no, I don't agree that Israel has a right to exist at the expense of another people,
yeah,
which is exactly what happened. But somehow, you know, that part of the equation is just totally dropped off. And it's like, you know, do you agree that Israel has a right to exist? And it also, from a lot of the times from, you know, the Jewish person that this question is coming from, you know, they've taken it that like, do you agree with me to exist as a Jewish person? And it's like, but sure, absolutely. You already exist as a Jewish person.
Mm.
What I don't agree is for you to exist as a Zionist Jewish person that comes from either Europe or a place, you have a passport, and then to go to the Middle East and, you know, somehow, you know, claim that you're indigenous from there and like still holding two passports. And, you know, so no, I don't agree with that. And I think people should be aware that anytime you ask the question of do you agree to Israel having a right to exist, you are basically agreeing to Palestinians getting murdered for this land and being ethnically cleansed for this land. So, you know, be very careful of that question, because that question is not a solitary thing.
Yeah.
It comes with the fact like Israel only exists because of the displacement of Palestinians.
That's really like the heart of it, isn't it? Like, you know, it's
the absolute heart of it. We can go on and like then talk about the fights and the Six-Day War and all this kind of stuff. But you can't place a dream of a nation. I mean, you can. It has happened. The Americas. The yeah. Americas were home to Native Americans. They were absolutely
yeah.
ethnically cleansed and wiped out. You know, where do you see the Native American culture or the sorry even to these people in a normal, you know, American public culture life? I don't see any Native American, apart from, you know, Scorsese's film there. America did have an indigenous population. So colonization could be argued at any which way. But the fact of the matter is a people have to suffer in order for a colony to exist or erupt or be born. And that's not right. So I don't know why.
Yeah.
I just, you know, the root cause, there's no problem with people getting an empty piece of land and being like, cool, we'll have a home here. We'll be safe here. There's no problem with that. I mean, we're human. The world, hopefully, is not just ours. Nature is also part of this world. But, you know, hopefully we can find a home anywhere on this world, but just not at the expense of another people who are already there, whose home it is. You know, that's just
yeah.
delusion
yeah.
for me.
Yeah. Has the fact that you have taken such an active role over the past few months in terms of your involvement with marches, you're very present, you know, you're using your voice in a way that perhaps you were using before, but I think you've just expanded, I suppose, the people now that you're connecting to mm-hmm. in a bigger way. Because I know, obviously, you're a really gifted singer. You're, you know, from the world of film. So you're a creative person, but you've been able to, I suppose, tap into the justice part of you in a big way. How is that stepping up part felt like for you?
It has been very freeing, I have to say, in the last since this all happened. I suppose I may have been at a crossroads myself in my life where I was slowly leaving the film industry, because I had gone in with dreams and, 10 years later, I'd come out like an industry head with no dreams and, you know, all about the hustle and all about the next job. And that's not what life is about. You know, I have become more free for sure. I won't be going back to not being able to say things that directly impact me as a human. You know, I won't be going. It was always there, but I suppose, you know, I don't know what video from Gaza radicalized me. But, you know, children who were in their beds, who have done nothing to the world, who haven't pissed off anybody, you know, who are effectively nameless, they were killed in their beds, you know, by airstrikes or bombs, or, you know, killed hugging their grandparents or their, you know, and that just changed everything in me. I'm like, what was I afraid of?
Yeah.
Who am I? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, what, like, if children can be killed in their beds and they haven't even had a chance, what was I holding on? What fear was I holding on to, of, you know, I suppose that fear just died. Absolutely. And I think it had to die because it didn't suit me. It doesn't suit my character to be afraid or to be hesitant about stuff that I feel very passionate about. And I feel very passionate about human rights and injustices because, you know, I had a beautiful childhood. I had, you know, my life effectively has been great. Yes, I come from two cultures that have been that have gone through such struggle of self-determination. So, like, there's fierce pride. And I've come, you know, my mother's family and being Irish, very proud. And, you know, my father's family and Palestinian. And, you know, I suppose seeing the camps and where my family lives. And, you know, I suppose I just, that needed to go. That hesitancy needed to go. And I feel free now.
Mm.
You know, it's... I lost all fear after watching certain things from Gaza where I was like, God, you know, they didn't even have a chance. You yeah. know, they didn't even have a chance. Like, what chance? How could a 5-year-old have pissed off anybody?
Yeah.
So after that, I was like, afraid of what? Afraid of losing a certain job that I don't like anyway, because I don't like playing the game, or I don't like being in a system where I am essentially someone's slave, or I am enslaved, or, you know, so that fear had to go.
Yeah.
It had to go. And, you know, it's not that I have all the answers or I know, you know, everybody gets afraid sometimes, you know, there's real fear to be afraid about. But we can't all be afraid. And afraid, like, I'm not afraid of losing things now. I didn't realize how unfree I was by the whole good girl conditioning, or like, don't put your foot out a step there because that's it. You'll never get the call again. You'll never be invited back in. And then I had to really have a think a bit. And then, you know, the thinking was like, be invited back in where?
Mm.
Like, you hate it here. You hate it here, you know. And so it, in a kind of way, it was like, that's no problem.
Yes,
I don't want to be invited back into a system where we have to conform, where we have to essentially be okay with being enslaved or not standing up for what is right because of whatever. And I was like, "That's grand. I'm so glad that those strings were cut.
Yeah,
and it, Gaza cut them.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Mm. And there is a fear of anybody in like the art cultural world or the film world, or the, you know, that, you know, you will lose opportunities because it's unfavorable for certain people to listen to, or it's, you know, they just don't want to hear it. And so you will kind of be ostracized or, you know, not included. And as if like, you know, that kind of like culture and art can only exist in these systems that are already in place. And that's not true. Like, we can make new systems. Like, we're all smart gals and boys, you know. We can take what we've learned and make systems that are ethical, that are actually put the human first and not the product first.
Yeah, correct. You know?
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And they're the conversations that are happening amongst people. It's as simple as, where am I going to get my cup of coffee today?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, actually, you know, I'm actually going to pop down there instead of there. And by that simple action of where you spend your money, you could be potentially making a positive difference. But you can continue to live your life with the blinkers on as well. But I feel like if you, because I think there's no getting away from, there's no way of not seeing it now at this stage. I don't know if it's possible to not be aware. You know, if you have a smartphone, I think it's virtually impossible not to be aware at this stage.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So therefore then you're making an active choice, and it's not about shaming anyone or making people feel bad. But I suppose that my question would be is, are you prepared to accept the consequences of that? Because I'm a big believer in everything being connected and things making you sick. So by actions that we make, if they're not coming from a good place, whether they're intentional or non-intentional, they can potentially make us ill. So I think, and when you talk about that, this time has been freeing. I do really connect with that as well, that there feels like, okay, this, as awful as this is and how much none of us wish this was happening, and everyone wants it, every decent human being wants us to stop and stop now and have stopped a long time ago. But with all of this, there is a kind of a no going back and we have to all now do better. And there's no point just, I suppose, saying the words. We need to kind of follow it up with whatever actions we can take.
And I have to say, in Ireland, loads of like people are just taking actions and initiatives that like I'm like in awe of. I'm like, oh, that's such a good idea. Maybe I can help out there. Or do you know what I mean? So like you've got artists here who have collectively come together of different departments and, you know, theatre, music, sculpture and all that. And they want to make apartheid-free spaces, which essentially is boycotting Israel, but from the cultural and art world.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not coming from a place of meanness. Do you know what I mean? It's not like, oh, you know, it's more so that, unfortunately, because of the Israeli propaganda machine and Zionism, the art world has been absolutely compromised by art washing. So it's like, Israel can go and do a genocide in Gaza, but they can also be a part of the Eurovision, which, you know, like, you know, if that's not a settler mind frame, colonial mind frame, like, what do you want to be part of the Eurovision for? But you also want to be the only democracy in the Middle East. Like, you're just contradicting yourself every 5 seconds. And frankly, it's boring. Like, we're not stupid. We're not stupid. So, absolutely. I, you know, and this is not a coming from a place of meanness. This is coming from the fact that the vast majority of Israelis today believe that the genocide in Gaza is justified for their own security. So we are not going to get a change in Israel. And this comes from Gideon Levi as well, who is an unbelievable
Amazing.
Israeli journalist and academic. And, you know, I've been reading his stuff for ages. And Gideon Levi's whole thing was that, like, he was writing about Palestine. He went over the wall to have a look for himself and was, you know, aghast at what he saw, and it was just like, I don't want it to be that Israelis never knew what was going on right next to them. So yeah. He's, but you know, Gideon Levi says, is like, you are not going to get the change from Israelis because they are nowhere near there yet. And that, and I suppose that because, you know, their whole indoctrination is so strong, their whole Jewish nationalism is based on the fact that they have to defend themselves from all sides, you know, enemies everywhere. And it's like, how has it not occurred that maybe you are the enemy? If the enemies are every single country, Arabic country in the Middle East, maybe it's you, you know? But this hasn't clicked yet.
No. And they're in that victim mentality that it's everyone else, everyone
yes.
else.
Yes. And so you can't work with that.
No, you can't.
You can't talk with that. Like, we'll be here all feckin' day. And so the best way to do that is like, listen, we want peace in the Middle East as much as Israelis and Palestinians, and we want to absolutely not be complicit in any wars that America funds or Britain funds. And unfortunately, we are all complicit. So we have to be cruel to be kind. And our being cruel is a very non-violent way. It's basically saying that Israelis are not allowed at the table until they play by the rules. And I think that's okay. So definitely there has been a big stand in the art and cultural world. Apartheid Free Dance has had, you know, done amazing things. And it's also to make the spaces safe for Palestinians. You know, we had a whole presentation and Palestinians from the West Bank and here talked and basically said they have, you know, they have been at certain competitions and have refused to go on the same stage as the Israeli competitive part because they're, you know, for some of them, those, you know, that's their abuser.
Yeah.
You know, the fact of the matter is all Israelis, it's compulsory to do military service. You have to do your 3 years unless you have a good excuse or you're super religious, blah, blah, blah. But they're all in on it, which is, you know, it's tragic.
And the Israelis that are speaking up and out against it are doing so with, there's a risk with that. Because, I mean, I actually follow some of them on Instagram and, you know, they're amazing and there are voices on the other side, and but they are, I suppose, they're vulnerable. They're vulnerable, actually, when they do that.
There is should be no illusion about how Israel was created, because Israel was created by blood. And what we're seeing in Gaza is essentially just a continuation of how they took Palestine and how they made people flee and how, you know, extreme violence. And for instance, like, you know, the stuff about rape, like in the Arabic world, rape is a very tricky subject because unfortunately it's steeped with a lot of shame and a lot of honor. And like, I don't know if Arabic, definitely Palestinians, you know, if they are as open with rape as maybe the Western world is. So for a lot of years, we didn't know that the women of Deir Yassin were raped.
Okay.
It was just like, it was, you know, ethnically cleansed. They murdered and killed people, but no one out of the Palestinian people that I know ever repeated the rape or even knew about it. Or, you know, I'm sure now it's all coming out now that they absolutely were raped. In fact, that's what made the fleeing so urgent. So it's just hilarious then. And then you have like fucking Israeli ministers and like literally just, you know, drooling over killing Palestinians and, you know, saying some of the most horrific things and, you know, and then lying essentially, you know, lying about October 7th. You know, I'm not saying it was absolutely a terrible time, but there were lies that were
a huge amount of lies, and we know that. Well, like, we know that now. We know that now. But unfortunately, those lies were spread for quite some time before organizations were able to categorically say
that never happened.
That never happened.
Yeah.
How are your dad's side of the family? As in, are they spread out? How are you connected to them? Is there conversation happening between you and them?
So my cousins and my immediate family that I would have close connections with are all based in Jordan. So they would have done the move from Gaza in the 60s.
Yeah.
But you know, I come from apparently a huge family. There's more than 5,000 El Sharifs in Gaza alone.
Right.
Gas, which Dad told me. And, you know, I don't know them. That's the truth. I've never gotten into Gaza, and a lot of them have never left. Some of them don't even have passports.
Yeah.
So a lot of who I know in Gaza from my family, I've gotten to know through the internet and, yeah. you know, trying to help out with like GoFundMes and raising money. But I suppose even with all of that is like Gazans shouldn't have to fork out or get 100,000, which is an extortionate amount of money, to leave their land. And then what? Yeah. What, be refugees in Egypt? Start all over again? Do you know what I mean? Like, we should be pushing more for Egypt to open the borders, mm-hmm. because that's like what they're doing is criminal. Absolutely what they're doing is criminal. Helping Israel starve. You know, I saw a video today, is it 2,000 trucks? Well, that's what I saw on the video. 2,000 trucks all waiting at the border.
Yeah.
Like, this is mental.
Mental stuff.
You know, so it's just, none of it is like making sense, you know.
And the craziness is a big factor of this, isn't it? It feels like that kind of sense of, how is this happening? How is this not some crazy messed up movie of a dystopian world?
Yeah.
When it's actually real life.
Yeah.
Real life. But that sense of not being able to actually
do anything.
Yeah. And the people who can do something and those in those positions of power are not doing nearly enough.
Oh, they've absolutely turned their backs on the Palestinian. The Palestinians have had no friends. That's the truth of it. You know, we can't get aid in on our land borders. We have to, some of the people are, you know, losing their lives with aid that's falling from the sky. Like,
yeah.
I don't understand. So I'm very privileged to be Irish, and I'm very privileged to have had the beautiful life I've had. Yes, sometimes carrying sorrowful stories or melancholy from people who have been unjustly treated. But it is because of the privileged life I've had, you know, that I'm speaking.
Yes, yeah.
I do feel maybe as a mixed child, or, you know, mixed person, I'm no longer a child. Jeez, I should really stop calling myself a child. But I do feel that, like, so I have a few friends who are also mixed. I've got this friend called Zara. Her mom's Pakistani, her dad's Mauritius, but she's a London gal. And sometimes we do talk as like, it's weird being mixed because you're part of both, but like, no one sees you as part of both. That's the truth of it. You know, sometimes it feels like you're part of nothing. And it's just, I suppose, like, sometimes I have definitely, now that I think of it, geez, I was awfully hard on myself for no reason. It doesn't matter. But like, you know, almost like, geez, is not Arabic enough to be a full Palestinian, that I, you know, people have made me aware, not Irish enough to be totally Irish, you know, not Muslim enough to belong, or, you know, and definitely not. So sometimes it just feels like, as a mix, like you're not doing anything right. You're letting everyone down. You're not being a true representation of whatever. And I suppose that also had to die, because that's just bullshit. I mean, and the fact of the matter is, I am not a true representation of anything. I'm a true representation of what happens when an Irish woman marries a Palestinian man and they have children and they drag them all over the world. So that's what I, you know, I can tap into the other that maybe Irish people would have found, oh, I don't know about them now. And it's just suspicion. It's just cautiousness, you know, of the unknown. I can tap into that. And I suppose another kind of interesting way is that, like, you know, I would go to my family in Jordan and they would call me the foreigner.
Right.
Like the kids on the street who weren't my family, obviously, because I was like this exotic, you know, cousin that spoke English weird. And I was called the foreigner and then moved to Ireland. And it was like, oh, it's a touch of the foreign in you, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, it's so funny. You've got two different people saying exactly the same thing to me.
Right.
So you're just like, you're all the same.
So did that kind of lead to a lack of, or feeling like a not a belonging, I suppose? Was there a concern with that?
Yeah, there was definitely a feeling sometimes that like, maybe I don't belong anywhere, or, you know, might have to try harder to be accepted, you know. And now that did probably come with moving to a lot of different countries. It was, you know, definitely my parents are gas that, you know, instead of getting a new job, we just like, you know, get a new country to move to.
Okay.
So definitely I
so you moved a lot when you were younger.
Yes.
And then teenage years settled
in Ireland when I was 16, and kind of, you know, becoming Irish was the missing piece. Do you know what I mean? Because you get so much from your Irish mother that is like actually so uniquely Irish, but you don't realize that until later. You know, I definitely think that if you have an Irish mom, there is a psyche that all us kids might, you know, and might be the same if you'd like, if, you know, just the format and the mix. I mean, I suppose I was born in Saudi Arabia. I grew up in Saudi Arabia. Life was very simple. But the funny thing was, is that everybody was international in Saudi Arabia. I went to an American school. You know, there wasn't, I didn't learn about whiteness as a concept until much later, because everybody, like we in Saudi Arabia, in the compounds we lived in Arabian homes, like the group of friends that my family had, it seemed that all the mommies were either Irish, English or Scottish or red haired or blonde, and all the dads were Arabic. So, you know, my dad is Palestinian. The Nassers were like Irish and Lebanese. The dad was Lebanese. The Galienis were Irish and Palestinian. So that format, that mix of having like essentially a white mother and an Arabic dad was just like super normal to me. I didn't realize dad was, you know, Arabic and Muslim until much later. We moved to Australia, and that's when it was like, oh yeah, your dad is totally different from all the other dads. But like for the first 9 years of my life, he was the norm.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose it's giving me and those listening now a better sense of your beginnings and what is all the different elements that have molded the person that you are today. And I can, I suppose, appreciate how important, weirdly, this time has been for you, in that sense of, as you said, that perhaps lack of belonging that you might have struggled with before, that's no longer features, that you do have a really solid, grounded sense of who you are, and you know, the pride that brings for you.
It's a journey. It's a process. I mean, I think everybody goes through their process of like, who am I? And maybe, you know, nationality or countries don't figure into some people's journeys. But for me, it really did, just because of almost trying to find my place in both, that I could be happy with.
Yeah.
That I feel like, you know, I wasn't letting anybody down, or I wasn't being not a good representation. But at the same time, you know, I'm not very good at following rules. So like, I didn't like any representation that I was in that didn't come from me. Do you know what I mean? So, but I don't feel confused anymore. Maybe that's just getting old. Maybe you just kind of get old and you're just like, oh, I couldn't care less about being confused about this anymore. Just feck it.
You definitely get a better sense of yourself, I think, as the years roll on, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The bullshit stops mattering. As much. That's what it is. The bullshit stops mattering, and you can very easily be like, oh no, that's bullshit.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't need to.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have time for it really.
Yeah.
You know, either. Nor true. Do you want to have time for it.
Mm.
Before we wrap it up, is there anything that you want to, that you feel like that hasn't been said that you want to say? I mean, you've already shared so much. I have found this to be really enlightening. I'm really grateful to you. But if there's anything else that you feel like you'd like to add?
I suppose I would like to show my appreciation to yourself and a lot of like you know, in the last 5 months and 6 months, I can only imagine what other people are going through as well. But Ireland absolutely has been a beacon of light for people like me who are mixed or who are Palestinian and who maybe have had a side that, you know, we need more than quiet solidarity or like, oh, it's terrible, what's going on? Okay, see you later. Like we, you know, and Irish people have absolutely stepped up by themselves, you know, have led the way by themselves. You know, obviously there's Arabic communities here and I see now that there's a lot of more integration, more talking, more connecting. Like these are all good things. These are all lovely things. But I suppose just to encourage and to keep on going, do you know what I mean? Because Palestine will not be over. And I suppose it, now that we have made a commitment to follow it through and don't be getting cold feet and don't be backtracking or don't be, you know, feeling like you have to police what you're saying, because these doors should have been broken down a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's the dehumanization of a lot of the global south that has led us to believe that they're not human or they're not like us or they don't like the same things as us. And like now we realize that was lies, you know, on purpose made to us so we wouldn't have a conscience about, or we wouldn't have a say. And now that our conscience has, you know, for all intents and purposes, woken up a bit more, you know, I believe hugely in people power. So, you know, we have to just keep going and we're mobilizing now.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely we're mobilizing now. So don't quit.
And also if you're listening and you're sort of on the periphery and you have been attracted maybe to listen to this conversation because you want to learn more, you feel like you've been silent so far, there isn't a judgment on that because everybody has
no judgment.
Yeah. And, you know, Ruth spoke about it brilliantly before where she spoke about, you know, I suppose the different responses that we can have to difficulty in our lives, you know, the fight, flight, freeze response, and that some people are kind of numbed to it or frozen in it and feel this inability to get involved. But you know what? It's not a scary place. I have found the people I have connected to in this time to be the most real crack-filled people, that just connections in this time have been the most powerful I have experienced. Because it's like you cut through all the initial kind of pleasantries that you usually attach to friendships where you get to know someone. But when you connect with somebody on something as important as this, you get to the heart of the person straight away. You get to see what they're about. I've had more laughs with people. I've had more tears with people. I've had more anger with people. And it's really connecting, you know, and there's room for everyone. So we want people to kind of get involved. There's the most gorgeous people in groups, and I'm a part of some of them, and there's, you know, WhatsApp groups and whatever. They're amazing spaces to get involved with, and you can really learn so much. I'm learning so much from all these people. And a lot of them are just normal people like us, people who have jobs, people who have kids, people who are just trying to do better, who are trying to learn and might put their hand up and say, I don't really know much about that. And then somebody else would jump in and say, oh, you know what, read this, or there's a great book here, or there's a podcast here, listen to this. It's great.
It's so great.
It's not judgmental.
No.
It's a very inviting space.
And I think that's kind of what this period has time. It's made people so much more open to stuff that maybe before they were like, oh, that has nothing to do with me. And now it's like, oh, no, it does. We're human. And like,
we're all connected.
We're all connected, actually. And, you know, I suppose there's no shame in anyone starting to learn from today.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is real no shame in that. And if you've been on the periphery and you just don't know what to think, you know, there's no shame in just picking up a book today or asking about it today and, you know, making up your own mind. Because essentially what people are asking you to do is just read a little so you can decide where you want to stand. Now, it should be quite obvious, but but do you know what I mean? So people need to just not worry. Like, there's no shame. I suppose the shame will linger the longest if you refuse to engage. And then that's really up to you and your character. If you've refused to engage on certain important things that are happening in the world like this, then, you know, it might be that people might not take you seriously later on when you want to engage about something that's maybe not as impactful.
Actually
fair enough. You know, so yeah. we've been asking people to engage and to maybe learn a bit so they can come with the conclusion that best fits them.
Mm.
Not because we're trying to brainwash people or that kind of stuff, but we are also absolutely trying to dismantle Zionism and lies that have led to the dehumanization, which have ultimately led to the genocide of Gaza. So, you know, I don't think we need to step around it or apologize or have to over explain. Please take note. I mean, this could be us next.
Yes. So, and that's the thing, you know, is that if we allow, which it is, it's not that if we allow it to happen, it is happening.
Mm.
What is next for the, you know, what is next for any of us? Because like it's, I get asked sometimes about the Irish language, you know, and, you know, because I speak it naturally because I'm a native speaker because I grew up with it. And I always say it comes down to geography because I grew up in a Gaelic area. Mm-hmm. It was my normal.
Yeah.
If I grew up in Gaza, my normal now would be maybe starving to death.
Mm.
That's the truth about it. Or I might already be gone. And that's it's as simple as that. You know, we don't get to pick where we're born.
Exactly.
We don't, you know, and in which world we grow up in. And there is no difference. And that's the thing, as you said, we shouldn't have to explain that.
Mm.
But that's what it comes down to. You know, these kids could be our kids. All these people could be us.
Mm.
And it's absolutely 100% wrong.
Once it clicks, once you see it, once you see those kids and you're like, they could be ours, you can't unsee it.
Can't, no.
And like, that's why every video, like, honestly, it makes you want to die.
Mm-hmm.
I started off, you know, losing my absolute rag and screaming on the internet and like, we have to do something. And then the penny dropped that, you know, no one's coming.
Yeah.
The penny drops that, in fact, not only are they not coming, they're egging this on. And that was like a real like, oh no, who are we screaming at to then? Who do we ask for help? Who's going to stop this?
And we have to be the ones.
And we have to be the ones, you know. It's a dirty game that is being played. And American imperialism is a very dirty place, as is British imperialism. You know, the fact of the matter is Palestine was a colony of Britain's and they sold us. Like the land, the Palestine was a land with the people. It was not for the British to sell to Rothschild and, you know, the elite British Jewry who essentially bought Palestine. And, you know, like you've got, what's his name, Balfour, writing a letter to Rothschild saying it's been accepted your request that Palestine become a nation for the Jews. It's just like, where at all was the voice of the Palestinians? Like the Palestinians literally went from being occupied by the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, to, you know, and they didn't know that the British were liars. They trusted the British who came and, you know, ultimately they wanted to stop being colonized under the Ottoman Empire because they were tired of all the wars that the Ottomans were fighting and they would be conscripted, a few different things. So, and you know, the British said, now I'm obviously paraphrasing huge talks here, but basically the gist was that like if the Palestinians revolted against their Ottoman occupiers, that the British would help them become a sovereign, independent state. And sure, they did that. They did as they were told. What did the Brits do? The Brits then become their new occupiers. And then it's like, okay, great. So now they're, you know, fighting the British and being hung and policed by the British. And all the while, there's like massive influx of Jewish immigration that's kind of being favoritized. And, you know, just so many immigrants coming, which is no problem, but it is a problem when suddenly the occupation, the British occupation, is now favoritizing them and, you know, almost causing rivalries with a new immigrant population and the native population. And so, you know, so that's what Palestinians have never had one day of peace, have never had a sovereign time. They went from underneath the Ottomans and they were part of Greater Syria then, you know, all, like Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Jordan, none of this was all a region called Greater Syria. Now, people were Palestinian, people were Lebanese, people were Jordanian, but there were no borders. Mm. You know, you could tell that you were in different regions by the accent, or the food would slightly change, or, you know, different customs. It was a very open trade traveling space until the Sykes-Picot Agreement, in which the Brits and the French and maybe a little bit of help from Russia carved it all up. And essentially, yeah, so Palestinians went under the Ottoman Empire, then went under the British mandate, and then the UN partition of Palestine in 1947, which was basically the Brits were like, okay, sorry, we don't know what to do here. There's a bit of a problem because now we're getting bombed by, you know, Jewish terrorist militia. You know, the word terrorist was first used by the British to the Jewish militia, which are the Stern and the Irgun and the Haganah. And these were militia groups that they came to Palestine on boats. They signed, I will be a loyal citizen of Palestine, and then immediately started planning on how they were going to acquire control of the whole region, you know. And first in their way was the British, you know, because the Brits were essentially the force. So, you know, they bombed camp. Is it Hotel David or I'm not even sure if that's what it's called. But, you know, the first bomb was carried out by Jewish militia, paramilitaries, you know, hiding guns in synagogues and stuff like that. So anyway, so that's just rambling on there about But basically, yeah, Palestinians have never gotten the chance to rule themselves, to be free as a sovereign state. And it gets worse the more you read. Yeah. So, you know, so just, you know the gist. You keep on going. And now that we've opened the barriers and the doors of justice and, you know, knocking down lies, challenging them, because they went on for so long without being challenged.
Yeah,
you know, that it was just the norm, and that's not correct. We're here now to end this genocide. Absolutely, we're here for an immediate ceasefire. We're here to hopefully see Palestine free in our lifetime.
Yeah,
and that begins in every space.
Yes, it does. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. There's a huge amount of work that required, but that everyone can play their part.
You can help. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, no one is at fault for all the wars of the world. Like, you know, we're normal people at the end of the day. We don't know what's going on, or like, you know, there's a whole elite world that run and, you know, cause wars in the Congo and in the Sudan, and all about resources and, you know, enslaving the native population so they are in charge of the resources. And that's crazy. Like, we need to get rid of that.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I would like to see, just besides the point, I would like to see the Congolese actually reap the benefits of their own country, considering that Congo is apparently like the richest country of natural resources. And, you know, the Congolese don't see that.
No.
Like, why? Why is it automatically that, you know, the Western powers that be have to be in charge of the resources when, like, that's stealth. But we've managed to legitimize it. We've managed to legitimize it in, like, you know, America, the land of the free, suits, white men, you know, everything is legit. It's not legit.
I think this has been a really comprehensive and important conversation that a lot of people will learn a lot from as well. So thank you.
No problem. Anytime. And thank you. This has been great.
The first time I saw you was when I heard you sing in Galway, and it was very moving. So it would be wonderful to hear you sing again.
Do you know what? I'll sing this song, which I've probably, you know, I sing it everywhere basically, but it's Fairuz. It's called Zahrat al-Madain, which is Flower of Cities. And it's a homage to Jerusalem basically. And this is how it goes.
Okay.
لأجلك يا مدينة الصلاة صلي لأجلك يا بهية المساكن يا زهرة المدائن يا قدس يا قدس يا قدس يا مدينة الصلاة صلي عيوننا إليك ترحل كل يوم ترحل كل يوم تدور في أروقة المعابد تعاني كل كنائس القديمة وتمزح الحزن عن المساجد يا ليلة الإسراء يا درب من مروا إلى السماء عيوننا إليك ترحل كل يوم وإنني أصلي.
واو.
Thank you.
Yeah. I can't put my finger on it, but there's such a, like the tone of your voice, even when you're singing. And it's different because I've heard you singing in English, obviously, as well. But the tone when you're singing these songs, it's almost otherworldly, isn't it? It's coming.
There's
an energy about it. There's a depth. And I suppose it's so evocative, isn't it? These songs are so evocative.
Thank you so much. And I do have to say, like, before this horrible time, I actually didn't sing in Arabic.
Did you not?
I was nervous about it. You know, I was almost like, maybe I'm not Arab. I know that sounds stupid now. It's crazy now to me to think that that's how I thought, because I wanted to, you know, I was getting better at Arabic. I'd gone back to Jordan in 2019 to like enroll properly and like, you know, just get better at speaking it, because I've always had it and I wanted to just be more confident in it. But since singing in Arabic, I'm a different singer.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in it.
Mm.
And I didn't realize it was at my disposal. I didn't know that it would also free me. I do go somewhere else when, now I feel like I'm singing with purpose. I don't know, or I'm like you said, channeling something that's bigger than me when I sing now in Arabic. It's good to bring them together.
It was what you were talking about at the beginning of the conversation, I suppose. You know, and that's the power of language and of place. It's the memory and all that it holds. And it's not about the here and now. It's about the generations that have gone before and the origins of how that song was created in the first place. And you're bringing all that into place. But it's really like, I've heard you sing that, but to be able to be this close to you and experience it, I was just like, wow, it was very beautiful. Roisin, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Shukran. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it
Shukran. No,
Shukran.
Great. Yeah.
Thank you.
Shukran.
This month, Roisin will be releasing a very special song with all the proceeds going to Palestinian causes. So keep an eye out for that. And please spread the word about the podcast. If you like what you hear, I'd be so grateful. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.